Back. Well, then, he'd still get what he wanted. He only had to fish it out of her. She clapped a hand to her mouth. It was hardly the most sexually shocking thought she'd entertained in her life. What astounded her was the waywardness and mischief of it, all ebullient optimism when she'd believed herself morose and listless. She loved him. If she'd been willing to violate the principles of decency in her youth, why couldn't she do something that was perfectly within the bounds of good behaviour, namely, showing up naked on his bed? Only think of the endless sexual possibilities. She tittered a little into her hands. She was a naughty woman, assuredly, and Camden had adored her for it. There. Nothing more to be said for it. She was going to New York City, and she would not return until she could inform Mrs. Rowland that she was at last going to be a grandmother. Chapter 27. The 2nd of September, 1893. Victoria's weekly tea with the Duke happened only twice. After that, it became two times a week, for a week and a half. Toward the end of that particular week, somehow they ended up in animated conversation by the fence of her front garden as he walked past her cottage. Then he invited her to come along with him. She accepted, and they'd shared the walk each day thereafter. There were advantages to being an almost hag, Victoria reflected. In her youth, she'd been fervently concerned that everyone should perceive her perfection. She mouthed only the most agreeable platitudes, and ventured not a single opinion that wasn't as bland as porridge for the invalid. Amazing what changes 30 more years of life brought about in a woman. Why, only the day before, as they toured her private garden, she'd declared His Grace blind for not seeing that the friendship between Achilles and Patrocles was more than friendship. What man would be so grieved by a mere friend's passing that he'd refused to let the corpse go to the funeral pyre? He, on the other hand, dug in his heels and defended the thesis of friendship. Romantic love, as Western civilization currently understood it, did not emerge until the Middle Ages. Who was to say that masculine friendship, in an epoch before a man saw home and hearth as the anchor of his existence, couldn't have been deeper and more emotional? Today, on a short stroll through his gardens, they disagreed on a host of topics already, from the merits of the metric system to the merits of George Bernard Shaw. The Duke felt no compunction in calling a few of her opinions preposterous. She, to her own pleasant surprise, gave no quarter and labelled some of his views as downright asinine, in exactly so many words, to his face. "I've never heard so many contrary opinions in my entire life," he remarked as they neared the house. "Alas," she teased him, "what a sheltered life you've led, sir." He looked startled for a moment. "A sheltered life? I suppose you aren't entirely incorrect. But still, shouldn't a genteelly raised woman such as yourself at least make an effort to agree with me?" "Only if I'm out to ensnare you, Your Grace." "You are not." He turned a baleful gaze on her. She batted her eyelashes. "Why would I want to put up with a man as disagreeable as yourself, when I already have all the advantages of wealth and a future duke for a son-in-law?"
"For now."
"Oh, have you not heard, then? My daughter has released Lord Frederick from their engagement. Furthermore, she departed this morning on the Lucania for New York City, where her husband resides."
"And that has slaked your bloodthirst for a duke of your own?"
"Temporarily," she said modestly. He harrumphed. The Duke had a soft spot for all things ludicrous. Between the two of them, her not-quite-hunting of him had become an ongoing joke. She smiled. Despite his dissolute past, his ever-present hauteur, and his great fondness for intimidating lesser mortals, He turned out to be quite a decent chap. His attention flattered, but the gratification extended far beyond the stroking of her vanity. She took genuine pleasure in his company, in the thoughtful, honourable man he had made of himself. Inside the house, the tea service had been set out in the south parlour, with a footman ceremonially warming the teapot. A fire crackled in the grate, shedding a golden tinge on the walls. "How remiss of me, Your Grace," she said, as the servants retreated. "I have been so busy informing you of your intellectual shortcomings that I forgot to wish you a happy birthday."
"You and 200 of my closest friends," he said wryly. "I used to throw a birthday bacchanal for myself every year, right here at Ludlow Court."
"Do you miss a good bacchanal?" How could one not, she thought. She'd never had one, and sometimes she still missed it.
"Occasionally, but I don't miss the aftermath. The wallpaper in this particular room had to be changed 6 times in 11 years.
She glanced at the walls. The damask wall covering was of a different pattern, acanthus rather than fleur-de-lis, but care had been taken to find a near exact match of the rich celadon green background she remembered, so that the room remained much as it was 30 years ago, when she'd come for tea and wild dreams. "It's remarkable how little the wallpaper has changed, for all that."
"Trust me, it didn't look anything like this during my more debauched days. The wallpaper featured other themes."
He smiled. Her heart thudded. Her almost haghood notwithstanding, she couldn't help being rampantly curious about the latent scoundrel in him. The least reference to his former wickedness had her in a lather, accompanied by one of those alluring smiles. Well, she could count on not sleeping much tonight.
"I had the old wallpaper duplicated exactly after I retired from society. I had everything duplicated, from memory and old photographs. But I found I couldn't really stand it."
He took a sip of his coffee. He'd given up the pretense of drinking tea several weeks ago, admitting that he couldn't stomach the stuff.
"So I made a few changes to suit myself."
"The past does exert a terrible toll, doesn't it?" she said quietly. He turned an unused teaspoon by its handle, down and up again. His silence was his answer. In his self-imposed exile there was a strong element of punishment, but it needed not be that way, not any more. "My daughter keeps a private investigator on retainer." Gigi and her modern progressive ways. She hoped the Duke didn't inquire too closely as to why. "I availed myself of his services on something that concerns you." His eyebrow rose.
"If you wish to know how Lady Wimpy's bed caught on fire, you've but to ask me."
A month ago she'd have blushed. Today she didn't even blink. "Actually, I'm more interested in those items of foreign manufacture and iniquitous nature to which Lady Fancott was apparently partial."
"They were only velvet-lined handcuffs. Foreign-made, perhaps, but hardly iniquitous," he said.
"Good gracious, what is wrong with that woman?" said Mrs. Rowland indignantly. "Isn't a nice strong silk scarf good enough for her?" He almost sprayed coffee all over the tablecloth. Good grief. This woman constantly forced him to re-evaluate his opinion on what being a virtuous woman entailed. Apparently, sexual creativity in a proper, earnest English marriage was not half as dead as he'd believed. "But I digress," she said, reverting to an impeccable demureness that hid God knew what other experiences and inclinations, a contrast rich in properties aphrodisiacal. His younger self would have expended enough wherewithal to wage 3 wars to possess her already. His current self did exactly the same, but only in his mind. "Now, where was I? Oh, yes, I had the detective look into the state of Mr. Elliot's marriage. He wouldn't quite compare her announcement to being shot in the chest, having lived through the latter, but it came perilously close. He felt as he had then, standing dumbly in place, looking down at his hand clasped just to the right of his heart, blood seeping out between his fingers. How could she, of all people, not understand that he couldn't bear to learn the truth of what had happened to the Elliot's marriage? That whatever peace and tranquillity he'd been able to derive from his hermit's life had depended on his not knowing, on hoping that he had not brought about the unhappiness of an entire family. Perhaps she sensed the magnitude of shock in him. Her face turned sombre. "I shouldn't have, I know." He glared at her. "Lady, your specialty is undertaking that which you shouldn't. Rest assured you'll face vituperation such as you've never imagined." He could have gone on longer, informed her of his exquisite command of invectives, and depicted in graphic detail the shrunken, pockmarked state of her soul after he was done with her. He didn't. There was no point in postponing the inevitable, though God knew he wanted to. "Now tell me what your detective has learned."
"They're fine," she said, smiling sweetly. His imagination was playing tricks on him. He thought she said they were fine.
"The truth, if you will," he said.
"My detective worked in the Elliot household for several weeks, and reported with confidence that Mr. and Mrs. Elliot get along very well, not just with civility, but with fondness."
"You're making it up, aren't you?" he mumbled.
How could it be? How could any human association that had gone so wrong right itself? Was he in error, after all, and man not quite as doomed as he'd long gloomily believed?
"You need not depend solely on what I say. The detective's name is Samuel Ripley. He worked for the Elliots for 3 weeks last month, under the name Samuel Trimble, as an underbutler. What I tell you is but a summary of his written report, which arrived yesterday on the late post. It is a richly detailed document, with all overheard exchanges and eyewitness accounts painstakingly recorded. My daughter is nothing if not prescient at employing people with the utmost dedication. It is clear to me that Mr. Ripley spent an inordinate amount of time at keyholes and upper-story windows. Why, there are sections of the report that I hastily skimmed over to preserve my womanly delicacy." His heart constricted, his throat constricted. The dark cloud of culpability had hung over his head for so long, he'd forgotten the pure, beatific light of a clear conscience. "I've brought the report with me, if you'd like to have it fetched from my carriage." He rose, fetched the nearly half-inch-thick document himself, and, standing next to Mrs. Rowland's landau, read every word of the meticulously chronicled domestic life of Mr. and Mrs. Elliot, not skipping any sections, particularly not those in which the couple engaged in activities that they ought to have performed no more times than they had children. He especially enjoyed the lurid, yet sweet, endearments they had for each other. "My darling little dumpling, my lord of the battering ram." Langford Fitzwilliam, His Grace the Duke of Perrin, returned to the south parlour walking on air, blinded by the incomprehensible beauty of the world. Mrs. Rowland had a glass of cognac waiting for him. "There, sir," she said, "you have not ruined a man's life. You may breathe easy again." He drained the cognac. Fires of joy spread in him, unabated. "I feel I can smile through 100 small country dinners." "That is exceedingly heartening news. I've at least that many people to impress by having a duke at my table."
"Only at your table?" he grinned. "Where have all your ambitions gone?"
"Not gone at all, only mellowed, Your Grace. I stand today quite satisfied to rub people's faces in our warm friendship." He tisked.
I'd have expected more from you, Mrs. Rowland. You do know what your revelation means, do you not?
The idea had been knocking in his head for some days. It had slipped in, like a determined lover, past all gates and barricades, to whisper by the fluttering curtains of the virgin bower that was his entire experience with matrimony. And the idea was, he would be quite happy to marry her if she would have him. But his past had weighed on his aspirations. What right did he have, hissed some dank, sinister voice, to the love of a good woman, any good woman, let alone one as beautiful, accomplished, and wise as Mrs. Rowland? What right did he have to happiness for himself, when he'd so casually despoiled the happiness of others? But that was no longer the case. He was an emancipated man, liberated from the bondage of blame and self-torment, at ease to enjoy the years remaining to him, with her by his side and in his bed, if he was so fortunate. The gleam in his eyes made Victoria's heart skip a beat.
That there is still time left to plan a bacchanal?
No, that it frees me to propose marriage to you.
She felt as flabbergasted as she'd been when she discovered herself in love with John Rowland.
You wish to marry me?
What in the world do you think I've been up to, madam? Have I not followed the rules of courtship most assiduously? Drinking tea, for heaven's sake! You should be flattered. I'd rather drink from my horse's trough.
I thought you wished to speak of bygone years,
or at most, make me amenable to a liaison. I do wish to reminisce, and I do plan to take you to bed, madam. Neither, however, precludes marriage.
But I'm going to be 50 years of age in less than 15 months, she cried,
and couldn't believe she gave away that carefully guarded secret.
Excellent news. That makes you a few years younger than I'd thought.
Her eyes went round.
You thought I was how old?
He laughed. I didn't. I took our age difference into consideration and found that it didn't half matter. Since you found happiness with a man 19 years your senior, there's no reason for you to be undone by a man a few years your junior.
I cannot give you any heir.
For which my cousin's son would be intensely grateful.
He took her hand, further disorienting her.
Allow me to assure you, madam, that the thought of infants at my age is profoundly distressing. My second cousin, once removed, is an upstanding enough fellow. I have no regrets about Ludlow Court passing to him.
She was tempted to say yes right away. Oh, how she was tempted! Not since the invention of chocolate gâteau had there been a greater temptation than what the Duke dangled before her nose just now.
Her Grace the Duchess of Perrin. These magical words exploded shivers of delight deep into her viscera. That at this stage in her life, with old age breathing down her neck like an over-eager suitor, she could still gain all the prestige and social stature she'd ever craved with the man once considered the most elusive bachelor in the kingdom. Why, what kind of fool could possibly respond in the negative?
She bolted out of her chair, jerking her hand away from him.
No,
she shook her head, her voice shaking just perceptibly.
No. Your marrying me would be little different from your efforts to restore Ludlow Court to a facsimile of what it had been when your parents were alive.
He frowned.
I fail to observe any similarity between the two.
Don't you see? Like the wallpaper, I was your mother's choice.
Am I to understand that in following my heart's, not to mention my loins, desire, I am but atoning for my adolescent negligence of my mother by fulfilling her wish posthumously?
She wished it were otherwise, but she wasn't blind. He liked her, He was physically attracted to her. But what separated her from the pack was that she provided a link to his lost youth.
Yes. You object to such a noble purpose?
Oh, drat the man. How could he be flippant at a time like this, when she felt herself about to crumple, held erect only by the stiffness of her corset? Because it is more wishful thinking than noble purpose. Your mother, bless her memory, would be proud of the man you are today. No further appeasement is necessary.
He nodded, at last appearing somewhat thoughtful. I take it that is your primary and overwhelming objection.
It is.
Any others I should know about? My contrariness, for example? My distaste for tea?
No, none at all.
She wished there were others. They would make it less painful to refuse his offer.
He smiled, a smile that 25 years ago would have left a wide swath of upended crinolines in its wake.
If that is indeed the case, then permit me to read something to you, my dear Mrs. Rowland.
He rose and walked to a satinwood writing desk that had belonged to his mother. More than once, the Duchess had gone to the desk to retrieve something to show Victoria during her long-ago visits. The Duke brought out a large vellum-covered book from a lower drawer.
My mother's diary.
He quickly turned it three-quarters of the way and then slowly flipped a few more pages, looking for an exact place.
Here's what she wrote on the 18th of November, 1862.
He lifted the diary, turned to face her, and read.
Had tea with Miss Pierce today, our last time, I suppose. She thanked me for my friendship and informed me of her engagement to a Mr. Rowland, a wealthy man with no antecedents of significance. A pity. Had planned to introduce her to Hubert. They would have made a pleasant match.
Hubert?
Was Hubert one of the Duke's given names? She'd thought his full name was Langford Alexander Humphrey Fitzwilliam.
Who is Hubert?
A cousin of mine, the Honourable Hubert Lancaster, third son of Baron Westport. Lady Westport was my mother's eldest sister. Hubert would have been about 26 at that time.
Her nephew? Victoria reeled. She covered her mouth with her hand. Merciful heavens! All these years!
A nice enough man, with a very respectable name and a very minor fortune, said the Duke. You mustn't forget I was all of, what, 15, 16 at the time? My marriage was far from foremost on my mother's mind, and for all her kindness, she was not unaware of our position. She herself had been the daughter of an earl. She probably expected at least as much pedigree in a daughter-in-law.
Victoria groaned.
This was more mortifying, even, than having her daughter and son-in-law thinking that she'd engaged in illicit acts to lure the Duke to her dining-table.
If you will be kind enough to have your footman fetch me a spade, I would like to excavate a 10-foot hole outside for myself.
And ruin my thoroughly beautiful gardens? I think not, my dear.
She heard him shut the diary and return it to the drawer.
It's no shame to let your youthful imagination get carried away. Far worldlier women than you have lost their heads over me.
Oh, that man and his arrogance! Her skin must have thickened nicely with age, for she was already in retorting shape. If you wish me for a bride, you shouldn't try so hard to have me expire from mortification.
He came so close that she could smell the lingering scent of his shaving soap. Her middle-aged heart began pounding.
This was actually going to happen. This monumentally desirable, marvellous, and interesting man esteemed her enough to want her hand in marriage. Her!
May I take your silence to signify that you've accepted my suit?
I've said no such thing,
she said perversely. You should. I've proved conclusively that I'm not doing my mother's bidding from beyond the grave. And by your own words, spoken a bare 2 minutes ago, you have no other objections to marrying me. None at all. He paused, rather deliberately, his eyes sparkling with gleeful wickedness. I see. You want me to exert myself further. Well, then, seducing a woman should be right up my alley, if only I could remember how. Now, do I kiss you before I lie with you, or only afterward? She summoned a pinch of mock outrage. As I said before, what a sheltered life you've led, Your Grace. It is both. I'm shocked, shocked, I say, that you do not know better. He grinned widely. I don't know why I haven't taken up with virtuous women before. I'm delighted to be making up for lost time. With that, he kissed her. It was neither the lofty, delicate kiss she'd envisioned as a nubile girl, nor the sin-drenched osculation that had lately dominated her imagination. He kissed her with gusto and delight, a man at last achieving his heart's desire. She melted, accordingly, in complete contentment. He pulled away after too short a time. Now say yes, he urged, nuzzling at the corner of her lips. Hardly, she huffed. I'm not signing away my independence on the basis of one kiss, as delicious as it may be. Remember, Your Grace, I was a married woman, a happily married one. You, sir, will have to demonstrate ability beyond kissing to persuade me to the altar. He laughed, a sound of robust delight. Glancing around the parlour, his gaze settled on a scroll-armed settee, upholstered in cream brocade. All right, he kissed her again. Be careful what you wish for, my dear Mrs. Rowland, or you might just get it. Chapter 28. The 8th of September, 1893. New York City made Gigi's stomach churn. Though she'd read that the city aspired to be the new Paris, she hadn't expected a very near copy of it. Certain sections of the city, with its solidly neoclassical edifices, their friezes and cornices plastered in motifs botanical and mythological, could easily have passed for parts of the right bank, and one particular church she passed on the way to her hotel had been an unabashed copy of Notre Dame. She could scarcely control her laboured breathing, though she walked with all the speed of a reform bill plodding through Parliament. Steady traffic flowed up and down the avenue, a percussive chorus of hooves striking pavement and wagon wheels creaking under their load. From a nearby street came the rumble of an elevated train. The air, though less polluted than London's, emanated the familiar notes of horseflesh and industry, though it also hinted faintly, and ever so exotically, of sausage and mustard. She made sure to inspect all the hotels, the shop fronts, and all the millionaire manses that crowded Lower Fifth Avenue. Still, the distance disappeared in no time. Suddenly, she was at the right intersection, the right address. She clenched her fingers about the whalebone handle of her parasol and wrenched her gaze from the opposite side of the street. No, she must be mistaken. Camden, in his perfect breeding, had always been so modest, so restrained in everything he did. There was nothing in the least modest about this gorgeous manor that looked as if it had been bodily lifted from some nobleman's estate in the heart of Europe. The facade was a pearl-grey granite, the jaunty, polygonal roof dark blue slate. The windows sparkled like the eyes of a flirtatious belle at her most successful ball, and every ornate line and sensuous curve spoke of high baroque and lavish wealth. She felt like she had the first time she'd seen Camden naked, flabbergasted, speechless, and just about falling down with excitement. She had not come properly prepared. To storm this particular citadel, she'd need much more of the paraphernalia of her own wealth and station to convince a suspicious butler that she was the real Lady Tremaine and not some impostor out to steal the silver. When the door opened, however, the butler recognised her nearly immediately, judging from his jaw bouncing off the black marble-tile vestibule. He recovered quickly, stepped back, and bowed. "My Lady Tremaine." Gigi stared at him. The man looked vaguely familiar. She was sure she'd seen him before. She was... Beckett! Amazement and guilt muddled her veins. When her scheme had fallen apart, she hadn't been the only one punished. As surely as the Empress of India was an Englishwoman of German blood, Beckett had abruptly left 12 Pillars because Camden had discovered his role in the scam. How could he, then, of all people, head the staff in Camden's service? "You are..." What could she say to him? And had he guessed, over the years, what her role had been in all this? "You are in New York?" "Yes, ma'am," Beckett said respectfully as he took her parasol, but offered no elaborations. "May I offer you some excellent tea from Assam while we see to your luggage?" The anteroom was glorious, the drawing-room nearly rapturous in its opulence. She'd been in royal palaces that were less rich in furnishing and art. And what art! As if someone had taken a section of the Grand Gallery of the Louvre and made it into a living space. Not that she didn't find it perfectly to her taste, but what had happened to Camden's preference for understated houses and impressionist paintings? "I have brought no luggage," she said. Now the all-important question. "Is Lord Tremaine home?" "Lord Tremaine has gone sailing with a group of friends," said Beckett. "We expect him to return no later than 5 o'clock in the afternoon." Surely they couldn't be speaking of the same Lord Tremaine. First, a house in which a cake-loving Marie Antoinette would have felt quite at home, and now this supposedly hard-working entrepreneur out frolicking when it wasn't even remotely Sunday. "In that case, I will call another time," she said. She couldn't possibly sit in the drawing-room and sip tea for the next 5 or 6 hours. It'd be too strange. She was beginning to regret a little that she'd asked every person in England who knew Camden's whereabouts not to breathe a word of her Atlantic crossing to him. Perhaps she should have sent advance notice. "Lord Tremaine is hosting a dinner tonight. Should I send around a carriage to fetch your ladyship from your hotel?" Gigi shook her head. Before a crowd of strangers was hardly the way she'd envisioned their reunion. "I will arrange for my own conveyance if I decide to attend, and you need mention nothing to Lord Tremaine." "As you wish, ma'am." "You should have your own children," said Theodora. She stood in a pretty powder-blue frock against the foredeck rail of La Femme, the 40-footer Camden sailed for pleasure now that he used the mistress mostly for business. Beyond the fluttering ribbons of her hat, a thicket of masts bobbed sedately. 1,000 ships before the topless towers of the financial district. Camden looked up from the plate of lemon cookies he was sharing with Masha. "How do you know I don't?" he said. Theodora blinked, then blushed. "Oh," she said. He didn't, of course. He'd always been careful. But he probably should have resisted the urge to tease her. The dear girl was never one for jokes. He used to think her beyond adorable when she'd earnestly tried to puzzle them out. But then he'd been all of 15. "Forgive me, that was flippant of me," he said. "You're right, I should have children. I would dearly love a few."
"But how?" asked Masha. "Mama said you are to be divorced. How can you have children when you're not married?"
"Masha," Theodora said sharply, her colour heightening further. "It's all right," said Camden. He turned to Masha,
who had her father's sad eyes and long nose. But beneath the face of a lugubrious Russian Madonna lurked a spirit as rambunctious as a dozen sailors on shore leave. "My dear Maria Alexeyeva, you are a very shrewd young lady. Indeed, that is my dilemma. What do you propose I do?"
"You must marry someone else," said Masha decisively.
"But who would marry me, Mashenka? I'm so old as dirt."
Masha giggled and lowered her voice.
"But Mama is even older than you. Does that mean she's older than dirt?"
Camden whispered, "Yes, it does, but don't tell her."
"What are you whispering about?"
said Theodora, a little put out.
"I was just telling Uncle Camden that he should marry you, Mama,"
Masha answered cheerfully.
"Then you'd be too busy to lecture me."
Before Theodora could recover from her astonishment enough to say anything, Sasha cried from the aft deck of the schooner,
"Masha, come here! I've got something tremendous!"
Masha promptly dashed off to help her brother reel in his big catch.
"Oh, that girl," muttered Theodora. "She is going to be my despair."
"I wouldn't worry about her," said Camden. "She'll fend for herself just fine." Theodora said nothing. She closed her parasol, held it with both hands before her abdomen, then set its tip down on the deck. Her index finger traced what seemed to be random patterns on the parasol handle. But he knew she was unconsciously writing down her thoughts. Got, got, got. She was embarrassed and discomforted. In this she hadn't changed much. Camden helped himself to another cookie.
"I hope you don't think that I came to New York because you are about to be a free man."
"You didn't?" He'd never alluded to his marital woes, but Theodora was quite aware of them, judging by what Masha had said. Theodora twisted her hands together, mortified. She was not accustomed to such directness from him. Mutely, she gazed at him, her enormous blue eyes beseeching him to assess the situation, infer what she wanted, and offer it to her without her ever having to speak a word, what he'd always done before. He sighed. She'd come at a wretched time, when he desperately wanted to be either alone at sea or alone in his workshop. He hadn't the heart to disappoint the children, so he'd spent the past 3 weeks showing them a good time in the city. But he had no wherewithal left to play guessing games with her. If she wanted something from him, and she did, something, then she could damn well come out and say it.
"Will you really divorce Lady Tremaine?" she asked timidly.
"She's the one who wants a divorce, therefore we are headed for a divorce," he said, more surly than he'd intended.
A letter had arrived from Adelshaw this morning, assuring him that the engagement ring he had requested from Gigi would arrive forthwith. He didn't want the damned ring. Wasn't it enough that he had to look at the cursed piano? He wanted her to come with the ring, but his ploy had failed. She would marry Lord Frederick, and he, what would he do?
"You will need another wife, won't you?"
Theodora's voice had dropped so low that he barely heard the last few syllables. He didn't need another wife. He wanted the one he already had.
"That is a question for the future."
"Gott hilf mir," her finger scribbled.
"Well, God help them all."
The children screamed in delight, breaking the uneasy silence.
"Look what we got! Look what we got!" hollered Sasha,
running toward them with a striped bass that looked to be at least a 5-pounder.
"Look at that!" exclaimed Camden, standing up. "I never caught anything half so big when I was your age."
He unhooked the vigorously thrashing fish and tossed it into a bucket of water.
"Want to have it served with a lemon butter sauce for supper?"
"Yes,"
the boy answered unambiguously.
"Right-ho!"
Camden lifted Sasha high in the air and spun him around.
Me too. I helped,
said Marcia, raising her arms up to Camden. He did the same with her, enjoying her high-pitched giggles.
My expert anglers, think you two can catch another one before we set sail?
They ran off, leaving him again alone with Theodora. He opened the lid of the picnic basket to store the remainder of their lunch. Half of a cold chicken pie, slices of roast beef, an almost empty dish of potato salad, and a few lemon cookies. Theodora came to stand beside him as he returned a flask of lemonade to its place.
I've been thinking of the past, of St. Petersburg, she murmured. Remember what you used to say to me then.
I haven't forgotten. He closed the picnic basket and stared down at it. But the truth is, I'll be bitter over the divorce. A new wife would find me lacking in both affection and care, and I love you too well to subject you to that. There. He'd finally admitted it. The divorce would devastate him, would come just short of annihilating him. He dreaded the post deliveries, dreaded any and all letters from his English solicitors, dreaded the eventual cable from Mrs. Rowland decrying Gigi's irreversible folly.
I see.
She sounded abysmally dejected, like a child being told that there would be no Christmas come December. He pulled her toward him.
But I will still take care of you, always. If you're ever in need, I'm just a cable away. And if, God forbid, something should happen to you, I'll raise the twins as my own.
He kissed the top of her straw hat.
I will take care of everything for you. You still have my word on that.
I guess that's all any woman could ask for, she said slowly.
The shadow on her face lifted. She smiled shyly and kissed him on the cheek.
Thank you. You are the best friend I ever had.
They stood thus for a minute, with his hand on her waist and her face resting against his sleeve. He sighed. Ironic that he should have his arm about Theodora on a boat that he'd again somehow named after Gigi, La Femme. The woman, the wife. But the sun was warm, the breeze cool. It was still a beautiful day, even if he couldn't have his wife. He returned a kiss to Theodora's cheek. Shall we sail? Gigi saw the horseless carriage as soon as she stepped out of the Waldorf Hotel at 5 o'clock. The beautiful piece of machinery, built around a phaeton chassis, black with trims of crimson, rumbled its progress majestically. The liveried manservant who drove it couldn't have looked prouder had he been atop the Queen's state coach. His pride was reflected on the faces of two of the passengers he ferried. The children basked in the admiration and curiosity displayed on the sea of faces turned toward them. The third passenger's reaction was harder to gauge, as the long veil of her hat effectively hid all her features above her chin.
To whom does the automobile belong? Gigi asked a doorman.
To the English lordship who lives 10 blocks down, ma'am, said the doorman. They say he's a viscount.
No, an earl,
said the other footman, and that's his sweetheart, the Russian Grand Duchess there. She's been coming up in his horseless carriage every day now.
Gigi felt herself petrify.
Camden lived 10 blocks south of the Waldorf Hotel. She'd counted it this morning. And hadn't the former Miss von Schweppenburg married a Russian Grand Duke?
She fumbled with the veil of her own hat as the automobile came to a quiet stop before the hotel. The passengers alit. The driver opened the boot and retrieved a heavy-looking bucket, which the children immediately took from him, causing their mother to issue a string of safety warnings in French. The driver bowed.
I'll bring the carriage around at 11, Your Highness.
Thank you, said Her Highness.
And it was her, the former Miss von Schweppenburg.
Who was going back to Camden's house at 11 o'clock at night, after the dinner crowd would have departed,
for purposes that needed no clarification. The bucket was passed to a doorman with instructions for the kitchen. Grand Duchess Theodora and her children entered the hotel and disappeared into a lift. Gigi slowly walked to a corner of the lobby and sat down. She'd expected to fight for him, given that he might have already taken a lover, to physically remove the other woman, or women, she'd had far too much time to ponder it on the crossing, from his bed and his life, if necessary. Any other woman. What was she to do now? Chapter 29.
If you do not mind my forwardness, Lord Tremaine, I think my Consuelo would make you a splendid marchioness, said Mrs. William Vanderbilt, nee Alva Erskine Smith.
I don't mind at all, said Camden. I've been known to be exceedingly fond of forward women. But I am, however, almost twice Miss Vanderbilt's age, and still very much married, last time I checked.
My, sir, you are such a gentleman, cooed Mrs. Vanderbilt. Her Southern Belle manners, however, did not quite disguise her flinty determination. But I have heard from numerous trustworthy sources on both sides of the Atlantic that you may not remain married for much longer.
He remembered Gigi's words. It's because you were young and you used to be a bit of an impoverished nobody. Expect the proposals to fly fast and thick now. After nearly 11 years, that prediction was coming true. This wasn't the first time Mrs. Vanderbilt had broached the subject in recent weeks, nor was she the first, second, or even third matron with a marriageable daughter to suggest that her precious girl was just the perfect candidate for him. All throughout the dinner, the first he'd held since his return from England, he'd felt on display, like a fattened goose about to be turned into foie gras. The smiles on the women were too bright, too ingratiating. Even the men with whom he'd shared cigars, whiskey, and business ventures for the past 10 years regarded him differently, with a sort of hearty approval better reserved for 16-year-old mistresses.
"Well then, my lord, you will come for dinner next Wednesday," drawled Mrs. Vanderbilt. "I don't think you've seen Consuelo for a good 6 months, and she has become ever so much more beautiful and swan-like, and—"
The doors to the drawing-room swung open, burst open, in fact, as if blown apart by a passing cyclone. In the doorway loomed a woman and a dog. The dog was small, well-behaved, and sleepy, snuggled in the crook of the woman's arm. The woman was tall, haughty, and ravishing. Her voluptuous figure poured into a sheath of carmine velvet, her throat and breast glistening with a Maharaja's cache of rubies and diamonds. And, ever so incongruously, she also sported a very humble sapphire ring on her left hand.
"Now, who is that?" demanded Mrs. Vanderbilt, at once peeved and fascinated.
"That, my dear Mrs. Vanderbilt," replied Camden with a glee he couldn't and didn't hide, "is my lady wife." Never in her entire life had Gigi felt so vulnerable, standing before a roomful of strangers and a husband who had another lover arriving in an hour. She'd already ordered a suite for her return voyage on the Lucania, and telegraphed Goodman to have the house on Park Lane readied. A cable for Mrs. Rowland lay on the bureau in her hotel chamber. "Tremaine has taken up with the Grand Duchess Theodora, née von Schweppenburg." But somehow she couldn't send it, couldn't admit that final defeat, not without one last gallant and largely foredoomed charge down the hill. Now all eyes were on her, including Camden's. There was surprise on his face, a measure of amusement, and then a nonchalance that did not bode well for her chances. She waited for him to acknowledge her, to toss her at least a line of greeting. But other than a few inaudible words to the woman next to him, he said nothing, leaving her to jump off the cliff entirely by herself. She let her eyes travel the drawing room. "Truly, Tremaine, I expected better from you. The decor is obvious to the point of atrociousness." A collective gasp reverberated from the high ceiling. He smiled, a cool smile that nevertheless ignited her hopes anew. "My Lady Tremaine, I distinctly remember informing you dinner was at 7:30. Your punctuality leaves much to be desired." "We will discuss my punctuality, or the lack thereof, later, in private," she said, her heart pounding. "You may present your friends to me now." Lady Tremaine couldn't quite keep straight who was an Astor, who a Vanderbilt, and who a Morgan, but it didn't matter. She had fortune, which they admired, and title, which they coveted. Her temperament fitted in perfectly with the energetic, purposeful, ambitious upper crust of the American aristocracy. Her independence earned her the approval of the wives, several of whom were sympathetic toward the suffragists. The men gawked, alongside Camden. There had been much surreptitious necktie loosening when she, later in private, unmistakably commanded him to shag her blind. The sexual energy she exuded was palpable. The response it provoked in him was downright atrocious. No other women came anywhere near him for the remainder of the evening. Even the unsighted could see that he was hanging on to civilized behaviour by the skin of his teeth, that if they didn't make themselves scarce, he'd commit public coitus right before their eyes, with his own wife. In the end, she did something almost as shocking. At precisely 11:00, she disengaged from the guests and placed herself at the centre of the drawing room. "It's been lovely meeting the very best society of New York, I'm sure. But if you'll forgive me, it's been a long journey, and I feel myself no longer quite equal to company. Ladies and gentlemen, my repose beckons. Good night." And with that, she left, the intricate train of her gown swaying majestically, leaving behind a speechless crowd, the ladies fanning themselves much too vigorously, the men looking as if they'd sign away half of their companies if only they could follow her out on the heels of her black suede evening slippers. "Alas," said Camden, keeping his tone light, "it seems I have utterly failed in my husbandly duties of guidance and discipline. I shall henceforth devote the greater part of my time and energy to that eminently noble endeavour." Half of the women blushed. 3/4 of the men cleared their throats. The leave-taking began in the next minute, and the drawing-room emptied at record speed. Camden raced up the stairs, charged into his apartment, and threw open the door to his bedchamber. She lay prone across his bed, her cheeks in her palms, studying his copy of the Wall Street Journal, completely naked. Those legs, that sumptuous bottom, the curvature of her breast squeezed round and tight against the underside of her arm, and all that beautiful hair spilled across her back. Carnal desire, already simmering, exploded in him. She tilted her head and smiled. "Hello, Camden." He closed the door behind him.
"Hello, Gigi. Fancy seeing you here."
"Well, you know how it is. Investment opportunities, etc., etc."
"Took you long enough," he growled. "I was about to hire dog nappers."
She licked her teeth.
"Am I worth the wait?" God above, he could barely remain standing.
"You were unspeakably brazen before my guests. I'm afraid you have laid waste to my staid, upstanding reputation."
"Have I? I'm terribly sorry. I must learn to be a better wife. If only you'd give me a little more practice."
She turned onto her back and slid a knuckle across her lower lip.
"Won't you come to bed and make me pregnant?"
He was on that bed and inside her in a fraction of a second. She was all hellfire and heavenly suppleness, clutching at him, her legs wrapped tight about him, her unabashed gasps and moans driving him mad with desire. He shook, shuddered, and convulsed, his vaunted control in pieces as he came endlessly, well on his way to making her pregnant.
"Will you remonstrate me for my lack of punctuality now?"
Gigi said later, still mostly breathless, lying with her head on his arm.
"That and your utter want of respect toward the beauty and splendour of the public rooms of my house."
"I like them. They quite suit my parvenu tastes."
The private quarter, which housed his impressionist collection, was, by contrast, cool and serene.
"I was looking for something to say that would immediately establish my English eccentricity."
"I think you've succeeded beyond all hope," he said. "They will prattle of this night for years to come, especially if you go into confinement 9 months from today."
She smiled to herself.
"You think you are so virile?"
"I know I'm so virile." He kissed her earlobe. "Let's just hope the second time's the charm."
She didn't immediately catch the significance of his words. When she did, she found herself scrambling to a sitting position. He'd obliquely referred to her first pregnancy, which had ended in a miscarriage. But she had never spoken of it, not even to her mother, had hidden it, along with her ravenous love, in the deepest recesses of her heart, a secret prisoner in the dungeon, whose clanking chains and whimpers of despair only she heard in the witching hours of the night.
"You knew," she whispered.
She shouldn't be so surprised. It was silly to believe her mother wouldn't have found out about it, and that once she did, she wouldn't have told Camden in the hope of forcing a reaction from him.
"Only years after the fact.
I got quite drunk the day I learned of it. I believe I smashed my entire model ship collection." He sighed, smoothing a strand of her hair between his fingers.
"But perhaps that was out of jealousy, since your mother mentioned the miscarriage in the same breath she invoked Lord Renworth's name."
She lay down again, facing him.
"You? Jealous? You're with a different woman every time I turn around."
"Guilty as charged in Copenhagen. But I didn't sleep with anyone in Paris."
What she really wanted to know was what he'd been doing with the former Miss von Schreppenberg. But his extraordinary claim about Paris perked her ears nevertheless.
"Who was that woman calling on you late at night, then?"
"A rising actress at the Opera. I hired her to knock on my door and sit in my apartment for a few hours so that you'd assume the worst and hurt as much as I did. But I didn't touch her, or any other woman. I was faithful to you, for what that's worth, until I learned that you'd taken a lover already."
That would make him celibate for at least 2.5 years after he'd left her. "Why? Why were you faithful to me?" she marvelled.
"Oh, I had no time. Within weeks after my arrival in America, I'd taken on such astronomical loans, I could scarcely eat or sleep for fear of defaulting. I was up at 5 every morning and never went to bed before 1.
He grimaced a little at the memory, then smiled at her.
"You could also say I had no intention. I wanted you. I wanted to stomp back into your life one day, twice as wealthy as you, if possible. I imagined decadent, histrionic reunions and wasted a river of sperm masturbating to these fantasies."
She knew what that word meant. It was what the muscular Christians were trying to prevent through a regimen of rigorous sports that would leave English men and boys too exhausted for anything but dead slumber, though she was sure she'd never heard it spoken aloud before. She'd thought it a dirty word. But the way he said it, as if it were the most natural thing in the world, made voluptuous images dance before her eyes. If she weren't already naked, she'd rip off her clothes and throw herself at him. She took one of his hands and rubbed the moist inside of her lower lip against the calluses of his palm.
"Tell me one of those fantasies."
He leveled a dirty look at her.
"Only if you promise to act your part in it."
She bowed her head with becoming humility.
"Well, I did tell myself that I would be the most obliging wife who ever lived."
He smiled wickedly, pulling her to him.
"Oh, this is getting better and better."
In between fulfillment of his inventive, at times highly unorthodox, fantasies, Gigi and Camden talked about the children they would have and all the things they couldn't wait to do together. At Christmas, they'd visit his grandfather in Bavaria. Come spring, she would show him the gorgeous west country of England and Wales. And in summer, if she wasn't already too far gone in her pregnancy, they'd sail the Aegean and the Adriatic on the Mistress.
"Take me somewhere to ride," she said. "I haven't been on a horse since you walked out on me the first time."
"I've a country house in Connecticut, on a pretty piece of land. We'll sail up tomorrow." Thinking of the arrangements made her remember Beckett.
"Your butler, do you know that..."
"I was the one who told him to go far away. We were both shocked when, 3 years later, he came for a position I'd advertised. He immediately begged pardon and turned to leave. I stopped him. To this day, I don't really know why."
Camden shrugged.
"By the end of the year, he'll have worked for me for 7 years.
Whatever his reasons, she was grateful.
"It's a well-run house," she murmured. "And what of his son?"
"He was in a Liverpool jail for a year or two, then went to South Africa when gold was discovered. He married last year."
She breathed a further sigh of relief. It was most agreeably humbling to learn that her sins hadn't stopped the earth from spinning, or other people from getting on tolerably with the rest of their lives. He traced her spine from her neck down to her tailbone and back again.
"Tell me about Lord Frederick. How did he take your decision not to marry him?"
"With much better grace than I deserved, to be sure. I only wish I could arrange for him to be happy always. But don't worry," she added hastily. "I'll leave him alone to live his own life. I've learned my lesson."
"Have you?"
He kissed her shoulder.
"That's what you said the last time we were in bed together."
She turned onto her back and placed his hand between her legs.
"Feel for yourself. Nothing there anymore between you and me."
She lost count of how many times they made love. Too much and still not quite enough. Sometime in the small hours of the night, he ran her a bath and laundered her thoroughly, making her giggle and squeal with all the naughty things a playful man could do with a willing woman, a tub of hot water, and a piece of fragrant soap. When it was his turn to wash, she looted the kitchen for food. He was in his dressing gown, toweling his hair dry when she returned, carrying with her a haunch of roasted pheasant left over from the dinner, a half loaf of bread, and a bowl of Morello cherries.
"My God," he said, tossing aside the towel to take the tray from her. "I had no idea you did things other than turning prophets and enslaving men."
She laughed as he set the tray down atop the large cedar chest at the foot of the bed.
"Allow me to shock you by knitting you a pair of socks this Christmas, then."
He smiled, tearing off a chunk of bread.
"Then I shall be forced to build you a rocking chair. Alas, my carpentry is quite rusty."
Tenderness, that most alien and disconcerting of emotions, swelled and billowed in her. She picked up a cherry and stared down at the soft, bright red fruit.
"I love you."
The last time she'd declared her love, he'd thrown it right back in her face. She waited uncertainly for his response. She didn't even have to wait a second.
He leaned over and kissed her on the mouth. I love you more.
All the sugar in Cuba couldn't compete with the sweetness in her heart. More than you love the Grand Duchess.
Idiot, he ruffled her already bedraggled hair. I haven't loved her since the day I met you.
But I saw her today in your automobile. The doorman at the hotel said she'd been seen in your automobile every day, and your driver said he was coming back for her at 11 o'clock at night.
Incorrect. He's going to meet her and the children at 11 o'clock tomorrow morning to take them to the train station. She has some relatives to visit in Washington, D.C.
Then you haven't been having an affair with her?
I last kissed her in 1881, and I don't miss it. A sly smile curved his mouth. So that explains your very delectable aggression. Perhaps I should keep her around to always ensure your prompt ardour.
Only if you want Freddy to set up a canvas in our parlour.
Won't bother me, as long as I can still have you on the piano. He grinned. I can never look at the damned thing without seeing you draped over it in all kinds of lascivious ways. Your sweet bum up in the... She threw the cherry at him. He caught the fruit and ate it.
I almost forgot, he said, walking to a writing desk in the next room. Look what news was delivered to my doorstep this afternoon. He brought back a telegram. She wiped her hands on a napkin and took the telegram from him. Dear Sir, stop. His Grace has persuaded me to the altar, stop. We wed yesterday, stop. We'll shortly depart for Corfu, stop. Yours most affectionately, stop. Victoria Perrin. Gigi covered her open mouth. Her mother. A duchess. The Duke of Perrin's duchess, no less. She'd suspected something, of course. But this, marriage, this was something else entirely.
Do you realise what this means? Said Camden.
That she'll take precedence over both you and me now? Gigi shook her head in both delight and stupefaction.
That the Duke of Perrin will find himself a grandfather in 9 months.
She laughed hard. The image of the Duke of Perrin suddenly becoming anyone's grandfather was much too delicious. She pulled Camden close and kissed him.
Do you know that you are the love of my life? Always did, said her husband. But do you know that you are the love of my life?
She set her head on his shoulder and rubbed contentedly.
Now I do.
The End. You've been listening to Private Arrangements by Sherry Thomas, narrated by Virginia Leishman, and directed by Erica Jensen. And thank you for being a Recorded Books reader.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.